co-workers on KRWG-FM have turned out to be longtime friends who keep up with each other's whereabouts constantly. If ever there has been discrimination at the station, or any cliques formed, it was almost always against a particular personality and not against a particular color, religious group, or any other kind of background. The outcast usually found himself out of grace with the students running the station because he was not reliable. Weirdness in character almost always assured a strong position around the station, not only in conversations, but in work. Fred Dabney's favorite saying has always been, "You've got to be a bit of a fruitcake to work in a place like this."
The following program comes to you through the...
Tommy Tomlin was one of the very busiest students around KRWG from 1964 to 1968. There was no title in the station staff that he did not hold at one time or another. He was student station manager, advertising director, public relations director, and chief cabinet builder. His enthusiasm never subsided. He seldom walked, he ran, and his days would have lasted longer than 24 hours had the clock allowed. After teaching journalism for a year or two, Tommy started his own commercial home building business here in Las Cruces. We talked with him at his office by phone this week and started him off reminiscing about times 10 years ago.
Well, first of all, let me say that it's a pleasure and quite an honor to be in on the 10th anniversary celebration of KRWG Radio. It's been 10 years, and it doesn't seem like it's been that long at all. We had kind of a meager beginning compared to where the station stands now. It was really kind of hard for most of us at that time to get into radio, because most of it that we had been exposed to was commercial radio. And here we were all thrown into educational radio. And there is quite a bit of difference, of course. And so there we were, everybody wanting to be top 40 radio announcer type and thrown into to kind of a foreign radio thing. And I think, looking back on it, that for that type of undertaking, for an inexperienced bunch of people at the time, we really did a credible job. I'm really proud of that. We were able to get ABC News at that time through the courtesy of KGRT Radio, and the management at that time said that we could carry all the newscasts and things that they did not carry, and ABC Network from the West Coast said that that was quite all right as long as we were paying to get the line from KGRT up to the campus. That was fine, that they had no objection to us using their feed on that. We were bound and determined to expand and keep things going and moving so that we could grow right along with the radio station, because, boy, once we got into this thing and found out how much fun it was, in addition to the work, it was a kind of thing where, you know, you really could get engrossed in this thing. And with the student people, we had a problem with some of the guys letting their studies go and spending more of their time down at the radio station, and it was a continual battle. As far as the faculty was concerned, at that time, Harvey Jacobs, head of the department, kept, you know, impressing upon us that it's great to spend all your time that you can down here at the radio station. We certainly appreciate it, but don't let your studies go, because, you know, if you want to stay in this kind of thing, you've got to keep both your academics up as well as your work at the radio station, so that you don't inevitably flunk out of school. I know that one of the biggest battles I had to fight as a journalism major and as someone who put a lot of emphasis on the radio broadcasting part of journalism, that one of my biggest battles happened to be at home, because I spent more time at the radio station than I did at home after classes, because I lived at home at the time I went to school. And my parents, kind of half jokingly and half seriously, would ask me why I didn't just move everything that I had there over to the station and save time and a little money having to travel back and forth from home. And it was hard for me to explain to them, as I'm sure it was for some of the other people involved, just how come we wanted to spend so much time at the campus radio station and do things involved with radio. Because I think if you talk to almost anybody that ever has been interested or involved in broadcasting. It's the type of thing that really gets into your blood. As we got involved into these things, we got involved in promotions and things to keep the students and people interested in the campus radio station. So they had a spring carnival at the university for many, many years, and it went in addition, was climaxed by the spring football game and then a dance type thing after. So part of our involvement one spring carnival time, I was doing public relations at the time for the radio station, and I came up with a good idea along with another major, Harold Humes, that what we should do is send off to Dallas to a costume renting company and rent a gorilla suit and play up the fact that running around campus loose was a gorilla terrorizing the whole campus. Well, the way we went around about it so that we wouldn't perhaps mistakenly be shot by one of the campus police or some other tragic event, we went down and talked to the chief of police at the university and said, look, we're going to be doing this promotion thing, and we're going to be hiding in the bushes and jumping out at people as a gorilla. So when they call and say there's some kook running around trying to terrorize the campus, not to get too upset about it. So over a period of week leading up to spring carnival, several of us got into the suit and took turns doing crazy and wondrous things that we thought at the time it was really kind of a fantastic thing. Look at all the stuff we were doing. And so we billed it as finally as a campus promotion thing on the radio that the KRWG good guys were going to go out and save the campus from this gorilla that was terrorizing everyone. And at that time, we had billed the fact that the gorilla had been captured, and we were doing a remote broadcast from the parking lot of Milton Student Center. And so we had had him up there on the truck, and it happened to be me in the suit for that prestigious moment in our campaign and our promotion. And there I was sitting on top of the truck, tied down to it. And the only problem that I had was the wise guys in the crowd as we went driving through broadcasting the fact that we had captured the gorilla, was they kept trying to grab my leg and pull me off the truck. And I had no desire whatsoever to be thrown into the crowd, a gorilla thrown to the lions or to the Romans or to the Aggies or whatever.
KRWG is 21 hours a day of programming that must be closely planned to fit the needs of a community in accordance with what's happening at any given hour. Waking up, driving to and from work or school, preparing lunch, cleaning house, relaxing, going to sleep, or studying late.
Many of our announcers served in Vietnam. We're glad to report that as far as we know, they all made it back safely. The biggest worry of the students were the draft lotteries and the 2S classifications. The students' lives were in the hands of politicians.
The fact is, we have troops in Europe, very large numbers, in Korea, Vietnam, Dominican Republic. We have military missions in half the nations of the world, probably more. I don't know what this means. It's all come about gradually in connection with an aid program. The aid program has been one element of this. I confess I've supported it all the time. I'm having very grave reservations about whether that was wise. I'm perfectly willing at the proper time, if I so conclude, to admit I made a mistake. Perhaps it's impossible for a great nation to do that. I don't know.
Robert Raymott, one of KRWG's first student engineers, transferred from the engineering college to the newly formed Department of Journalism and Mass Communications in 1964. After leaving NMSU, he worked several years at KGRT, then took on the directorship of engineering at WGAR in Cleveland, Ohio. Bob was another hefty-sized member of the station who one morning fell through the ceiling of the studio while trying to trace a wire in the barracks attic. Here are some of his other memories as he recalled from Cleveland.
Well, I remember the old days, KRWG's beginnings. I remember when we were installing the antenna up on top of the Aggie Memorial Tower, as a lot of people called it, the singing silo. Well, the large flower pot on the southwest corner, I believe, was being removed to install the antenna base. It fell to the concrete, causing a large smash in pottery and everywhere. The transmitter that we used back in the old barracks had to be uncrated and put in the building before the walls were put up, because there really was no way to get it into those narrow hallways in the barracks and to put the transmitter in. I can remember the first days when the general manager, Bonnie Stanford, was showing people around the station the first couple of days that it was on the air. And as all broadcast equipment is, it's interlocked. In other words, it'll go off the air if anybody opens a door or anything. It's mainly to protect people. And I remember these two doors on the back of the transmitter, which were interlocked. And he was showing the station off and proceeded to open the back door of the transmitter and point out what the inside of the transmitter looked like. Of course, at the moment, he did not know that the transmitter had gone off the air. And so we began a club of those that opened the back door and turned the station off. And I remember Monty Stanford, the general manager, being the very first one to belong to that club. And there was a sign on the back of the transmitter that constantly kept falling down or was held down for one reason or another, because his name was at the top of the list. Oh, yes. I also remember another little couple of incidents that occurred. The station was always expanding, and with the advent of the film department, we were looking for a place to install a darkroom. And there was only two places down at the end of the hall. One was the men's restroom, and the other was the women's restroom. And one of them had was obviously larger than the other, so we thought, well, that would be an excellent place for a darkroom. So the women's restroom became the darkroom. And, of course, the men's restroom got this sign done by David Charles that was a flexible Playboy-type sex symbol that could be, man or woman, whichever. And you just go ahead and put it on it before you went in, locked the door, and that was fine. So we took the commode, and we set it out on the front steps for the longest sort of time. And somebody got the clever idea, says, well, we'll put this little sign above it. And the sign said, Department Head. Another thing that I there were a couple of things that were very interesting. We had a traffic director, a continuity person by the name of Grace Harker. And I remember we used to call her Racy Gracie, as I recall. But one night she was working hard, and I guess she was studying or whatever the case was. She went into the traffic office, and she closed the door. The doorknob fell off. Well, actually, the door did more than just close. It locked. So called Physical Plant, the great expedient lock fixer-uppers that they are, and they promised us that all we'd have it taken care of by 9 o'clock the next morning. Well, she certainly couldn't sit in there for 9 or 10 hours. So we called, and finally they sent someone over to get her out. But the expression on her face and in her voice when she found out she was going to have to sit in that traffic office for 9 or 10 hours was just unbelievable.
School was out between the spring semester and the first summer session during the Six-Day War in the first week of June 1967.
The announcement on Cairo radio came at 9:47 this morning, nearly half an hour after the first air raid alert had sounded. Israeli forces have begun attacking Egypt, the radio said, and our forces are striking back. There was no sign of panic. On the contrary, there was jubilation in the streets. Wild cheers and chanting when the radio claimed a first indication of victory, 23 Israeli planes shot down. Later, a second alert and a second official claim. The total of Israeli planes destroyed had jumped to 70.
Several faithful DJs hurried back to the station from vacation after receiving anguished letters from station manager Lyndon Fisher, telling over long hours manning the board and unexplainable technical difficulties.
One of my memories of KRWG, of when I feel I really goofed off and was made quite an impression, it's one of the things that stuck with me in the years since I've been with KRWG, I was working as the station manager, and I had quite a job keeping all the students in line, being responsible, professional-sounding students. So little things that might not really have been all that important, I remember that I usually chewed somebody out about. One vacation, when the students were gone, that was always my time to take over and be on the air to keep the thing going. Anyway, I got on the air and was getting fairly late in the evening, building up to an 11 o'clock news broadcast. My brand new husband at that time, who was also in the journalism department, he was preparing the news. He was going to do the news. I had been a single voice all evening long with the music, and my husband Bob was going to do the news. So he had worked on the news, and he had edited this news better than almost any news ever got edited around there. He had carefully rearranged the stories with high priority newscasts coming first and so on. He had his news all ready, and he was standing there ready to go ahead with the news. I was playing a song called Winchester Cathedral at that time, and was going through, went entirely through the song. I saw that I was had a few minutes left, and so before news, I decided since it was an instrumental song, I would just back it up a little bit, and so I said, "And one more time." And there we went with a little more of Winchester Cathedral. Only after I said, "And one more time," the transmitter went, and we were off the air for 2 days. And I had to explain to Mr. Jacobs, who had heard about this sort of certainly not KRWG-FM sound of having an announcer blurting out something or other about one more time. He was also a little bit upset about the news not going on that night. And my husband was a little bit upset because by 2 days later, his news was very dead and stale. So that's one of the memories that that I have of KRWG.
Lyndon Fisher, station manager, asked John Athey, program director, not to interrupt Sunday's musical theater to broadcast President Johnson's address on March 31, 1968, because other radio and TV stations would be covering it. John persisted and broadcast the president's speech anyway. It was rather an important presidential address.
It is true that a house divided against itself is a house that cannot stand. There is division in the American house now, and believing this as I do, I have concluded that I should not permit the presidency to become involved in the partisan divisions that are developing in this political year. Accordingly, I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
To students, KRWG is a training ground, a laboratory, sometimes a torture chamber.
And now a collection of all the little problems we have. The first is on journalese, and I'm afraid is attributed to myself.
Warms my heart to know that you remember still.
Night, when we had our last rendezvous.
Alan Taylor is pretty good with needles on records, too. For instance, the night he made a 15-minute transcription, 45 minutes long.
What happened was we had this jacket right here, you see, and the record was going, and I turned the chair to check my needle reads, and this thing rode up on the record.
Oh, no. Yeah, God damn it.
And who can match Wayne Budwine's technique for running newscasts on The Late Late Show?
Very definitely a crime.
At a news conference in Fort Worth this morning, GOP National Chairman George Bush says this about Watergate.
Life goes on, and that people are not going to unfairly blame party for the alleged malfeasance of the few. I feel strongly about this.
GOP Chairman George Bush. I'm John Lloyd, American FM Radio.
You know the feeling? It's one of those nothing days.
Periodontal or gum disease destroys the tissues and structures that hold teeth fast in their face. It accounts for 75% of tooth loss under age 40 and affects 2 out of 3 middle-aged Americans. Research explores pyorrhea and other gum diseases. A book was published by ATW's National Institute of Dental Research that tells how you can help protect against this affliction. For your free copy, write to Radio NIH, Bethesda, Maryland, 20014. Ask for publication 1482.
In the Watergate bugging case, are accused of being involved in the Pentagon Papers case.
Around 8 o'clock each Thursday, Ray Hanke uses a similar technique as he cues up tapes to be played.
That are subject to an investigation he was conducting for the FBI. President Nixon has named William Ruckelshaus to be acting director of the FBI. Ruckelshaus has been head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Ruckelshaus says he'll run the FBI only until President Nixon finds a permanent director.
It's cramming for Federal Communications Commission's exams the night before leaving for Albuquerque. All broadcasting students must get their federal license before going on the air. Few pass the exam, but those who do must wait 6 to 8 weeks to find out.
Julia Ming came to NMSU from Raton, New Mexico, where she had worked on radio station KRTN during high school. She, too, was bitten by the broadcasting bug. She came to dinner and stayed. She is currently production coordinator for McGraw-Hill 7 Productions at Denver's KMGH-TV, formerly KLZ-TV.
I came down there originally just for a journalism seminar that was going to be held, a mass communication seminar, in the summer. In fact, I wasn't even planning to go to school down there. And I got so enthralled with the situation down there during the summer that I decided to change my mind and come down to school there. I remember the first time I was ever on AM, Tommy Tomlin was trying to teach some of us what to do, and he said, "Now, be sure to always close your mic after you've introduced a record." So he was standing there, and a few other people were, and I introduced a record, and I turned around to say something, and I said, and I didn't have my headsets on, and I said, "Hey, I can't hear the record. What's the matter?" And then I realized that my mic was still on. The first time that I ever had to do one of the 8 o'clock reports, which for some reason I rarely broke up over a newscast, but so people kept trying to do this to me. And so Richard Pachalski suddenly walked into the newsroom, and the door was right ahead of the board. And he walked into the newsroom with this red scarf that I'd had in my coat pocket on his head, pulled down almost to his eyebrows. He had on my green corduroy coat, and he'd rolled up his pants legs. And besides that getup, he was carrying my purse. Well, that almost got to me, but when it didn't, he came along and walked over and got up on the news desk and started walking across my newscast. And about that time, a class let out, and they were coming down the hall, and they saw what was going on, so they were watching all of it. And I had set my weather forecast up on top of the board so that I wouldn't lose it when it came time to give it. And Bob Raymond walked in and stole the weather forecast, so I had to ad-lib my way through that, and I couldn't remember what any of the temperatures had been or were supposed to be or anything else. And to top it all off, Richard had picked up a dirty broom and was combing my freshly washed hair with the dirty broom. And somehow I made it through that newscast, but there was all this raucous laughter out in the hall. And shortly after we got off and they had started into the next program, the phone lit up, and it was Mr. Jacobs. And he wanted to know what in the world was going on down there, because all of that laughter had gone out over the microphone while the newscast was on. We did have a strike at one time. It had to be 67. And AFTRA was having a strike, and most of us really didn't feel that it, what they were doing was exactly the right thing to do. So we staged a strike just to show how basically silly we thought the idea was and everything. But we had some demands that we made with our strike, and they were things like a water fountain and some pay and separate restrooms. And, oh, boy, would some women's lib groups get upset with us over that. But we did, after all, get a water fountain, which I don't think any of us expected. We had pickets out in front of the building. I don't remember what the signs say now. I know I have some pictures of the pickets out in front. And then they negotiated with management, and none of us would cross the picket lines except to get a Pepsi or something.
To listeners, KRWG is information.
The most memorable part about Martin Luther King's assassination was a very sad commentary on Americans all across the country. Some of the students cheered at the death of Mr. King, and other announcers nearly cried. At the time of his death, it was not really clear as to whether Martin Luther King was really as nonviolent as he was reported to be. Several weeks before his death, KRWG did a special documentary utilizing an FBI report saying that King was a member of the Communist Party. Whether that report was true or not, the time of his death caused a division of opinion around the station and some rather bitter feelings that are remembered to this very day.
Thursday evening, Senator Robert Kennedy was in Indianapolis.
Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort.
The assassin's bullet hit Dr. Martin Luther King as he stood on the balcony of his hotel. Reverend Jesse Jackson was in Memphis below the balcony when it happened.
I ducked, not knowing how many other bullets would come. Turned around and looked. And people were, some were pandemonium, some were in shock, some were crying, hollering, oh God. And I immediately started running upstairs to where he was, and I caught his head, and I tried to feel his head, and I asked him, I said, Dr. King, do you hear me? Dr. King, do you hear me? And he didn't say anything, and I tried to hold his head.
Is anybody here? See my old friend Martin.
KRWG-FM is a 100,000-watt transmitter in the desert west of town that must be tended to daily and babied when broken.
One of our favorite staff members around KRWG is Chief Engineer James Doran, who is the best engineer in the whole state, without question. We can prove that statement because every radio and television station in New Mexico has tried to hire him away from us. The best they can do is to fly him wherever they need him. Single-handedly, he put both the 100,000-watt station on the air in 1970, and then, with very little help, did the same thing 3 years later with KRWG-TV. Jimmy D, as we've nicknamed him, can be pointed out to someone who does not know him as the man in coveralls rubbing his belly.
It's a real pleasure for me to be on the program here today. After almost, 6 years now I've been here steady, and then, of course, my earlier association with KRWG goes much further back than that. Matter of fact, it goes back to 1955, if you want to go back that far. Most people don't. But anyhow, let's see where we were. I returned from Durango, Colorado in the summer of 1964 and was employed as the chief engineer here at KGRT in Las Cruces. About that time, Jack Selmayr, who was the former chief engineer there, was constructing the new first stereo FM in the state of New Mexico. It's hard to believe in this day and age, with all the multiplicity of stereo stations around the country and as well as our neighbors to the south and even here in New Mexico. There were some FM stations in the area, of course, but we were the first stereo station in Las Cruces and in the state. But I've heard that Jack was building this thing, and so during the summer he progressed along with it, along with another friend of mine named Jim Tunney. Jim is now with the Mosley Associates people out as the design engineer in Santa Barbara, California. And Jack is now back with Collins Radio after being around with a few other radio companies in the meantime. And he is a design engineer for Collins. They worked through the summer, and we ran the final proof of performance measurements, as they're called, just before airtime on October 3rd of 1964. I was employed as what they call a part-time engineer after Jack left to resume his studies at Arizona State in Tempe, and I kept the station going, a couple of months until other things pressured me into leaving, and was taken over by Dave Shaw, who's now up in Albuquerque, works for KOAT-TV and for KPAR as their engineers up there. Dave kept it, a year or so, and then we had a variety of student engineers. Ronnie Renfro was one, and then there was Robert Raymond was another, and Dale Montgomery did some work on it. These were all people that are long gone now and gone on to bigger and better things as a result of their education at New Mexico State University. And we like to think that it was all started here with, KRWG and part of the engineering department and the things that went along. It's been an enjoyable time. The station was 746 watts ERP, effective radiated power at that time, and as soon as I came to work full-time in 1969, in January, Harvey Jacobs asked me if I would undertake to get the thing up to 2,700 watts, and we did this within about 3 months. The antenna was available. Most of the preliminary engineering work had been done by O.C. Crossland, who had preceded me as the full-time engineer at the station. And we went ahead and put on 2,700 watts in the spring of 1969. Well, no sooner was that done than Harvey handed me a great big brochure full of interesting little forms, and it says HEW on that. Health, Education, and Welfare. Educational Broadcasting Facilities Program. And he says, Jim, do you think you could handle this? And well, what it was, we applied for 340,000 watts ERP in the fall of 1969. Well, as would have it, there are no stations licensed for that power, and the commercial stations are licensed for a maximum of 100,000 watts. So the FCC said, well, you can't do this. You'll just have to reapply, and that took another 3 or 4 months. And in the meantime, funding became a problem. To install a 100,000-watt station took a considerable amount of time and a considerable amount of money. So we refiled, and it was held up in litigation for, almost a year, whether or not we could finally get the thing. And HEW did come through with some money, and the Ford Foundation was kind enough to help us out also. Mr. Harold Service obtained that money, and we eventually got the 100,000-watt station, which I think was Harvey's greatest day. Matter of fact, I had a letter from him the other day that he... I wished him a happy birthday, and his birthday is on September 6th. And that's when we pushed the button for the 100,000 watts in September 6th, 70. I know one time Harvey called me up, and at the time I didn't have an FM receiver. I just don't have one. I'm like the proverbial barber, you know, whose kids never have a haircut, or the shoemaker whose kids never have shoes. Well, I never have any equipment of my own that seems to be at the house. So Harvey called me up one night. He says, "Jim, are you listening to the station?" And I says, "Well, no." He says, "Don't you ever listen to it?" And I says, "Well, no." And he said, "Well, I wish you would." Well, he didn't know at the time that I didn't have an FM set, but he was rather hurt that I didn't listen to that station. And the reason was I didn't have an FM receiver to listen to it. But by and by, Harvey loved that station, and he listened to it all the time. And I think it was well worthwhile because it made him interested. And it made the people interested in what he was listening to. So if somebody goofed or mispronounced a classical name, why, of course, he was the first one to be on the telephone and call him up and tell him about it. Gently, chiding, of course, sometimes a little more so. Oh, I'll tell you one little thing that happened the other day. You know, we were out at the transmitter, since I've been checking out Rodney Norris as the new transmitter engineer for both TV and FM. And we've been checking over the TV transmitter for the past 2 weeks or so. And as you would have it, we were just standing there looking at the FM transmitter, not even doing anything. And all of a sudden, it just went off the air. All right? So we push the plate button back on, and it goes back on. And, of course, it goes back on for about umpteenth of a second. And a great big blue flash comes out of the top of it, and it promptly goes off the air, knocks all the lights out in the building, and takes the TV transmitter off the air. So all I can say is it's like a woman. If you don't pay any attention to it, it's sure going to let you know about it.
Jimmy, if you haven't looked on the door to Studio A today as you've walked by, you might do so first thing tomorrow morning. This last year, program director John Athey began naming the doors in the FM station after the people who have done the most for KRWG. Our library door has a plaque reading the K. Ammons Record Library, because Mrs. Ammons of Oregon, New Mexico, has given us so many grants for new records. The FM studio door reads the Harvey C. Jacobs Control Room, because without Mr. Jacobs, the control room might still be in the old barracks, if there at all. Now our large multi-purpose studio bears the name James A. Doran, because of his untiring work to build this station, to keep the station in tip-top shape, and to instruct hundreds of students in the fundamentals of broadcasting. Jim, we honor you, we respect you, and we love you. Actually, Jimmy didn't let on too much about the trouble we had increasing power in 1970, but the problems touched everything and were spread out over a year or more. It was not certain 24 hours before we moved the station across campus on Friday, September 4th, whether or not we would indeed be signing on Sunday, September the 6th. John Athey, the program director, produced the following soap opera, which compiles, in not too much exaggeration, all of the troubles we've suffered. Truth is funnier than fiction.
Another sad story on As the Station Moves.
Brought to you by McGovern's, makers of the finest in one-rung stepladders for midget peeping toms.
Today's program, chapter 2743, is entitled Button, Button, When Will We Push the Button? You will remember on our last program, the Department of Journalism and Mass Communications moved out of the termite-infested, reclaimed World War I Army barracks, which it had occupied since 1960-something, and had moved into the newly renovated, spacious quarters in Milton Hall. KRWG-FM, however, was left behind in the old barracks, awaiting completion of new studios in Milton Hall, the erection of a new broadcasting tower and transmitter site 22 miles west of Las Cruces, and the arrival of a new 100,000-watt transmitter. Poor KRWG was left behind and nearly forgotten visited only occasionally by the university exterminator, who voraciously threatened to spray the building with an insecticide that would cause the termites to quit holding hands and the barracks to collapse. And you will remember that KRWG's new tower was delayed in shipping. Oh, this material is sad. And that the new coaxial cable from the transmitter to the top of the tower was kinked one day last May as part of Arizona was making its way to Texas. A new cable was ordered immediately and was unwittingly delayed by a trucker strike in Chicago. And then you will remember that when our new transmitter was turned on for the first time, it went... Our harried technical supervisor then attempted an unprecedented jump from the tower to end his perpetual problems with the radio station. But... Alas, the rodeo arena had been flooded by two old rodeo hands drooling over the latest issue of Playboy. And, if you can still remember, a July 16th recreation of the atomic bomb Trinity site successfully wiped out the Doña Ana County Fairground sheep pens. But more important, it was learned that the station's tower was so located on the high desert mesa that the signal should miss most of Las Cruces in the valley below. Jackrabbits for 250 miles around should have outstanding reception, however. And if your memory is still holding out, you might recall that much of the equipment for the new station was inadvertently shipped to New Mexico State University by way of Hilo, Hawaii.
Mrs. Leslie Gunch of Pacoima didn't believe us when we told her she could wash her clothes in cold water. What changed your mind, Mrs. Gunch?
A new improved Cremins liquid with the miracle ingredient Cremaclean and a check for $84.
When we left James Dorian, technical supervisor, Bill Worthington, his assistant, Harvey C. Jacobs, department head, Harold Service, general manager, and John Athey, program director, they had just stepped out of the staff meeting, each of them totally bald. They had decided during the meeting to save time by pulling out each other's hair. And now we rejoin James and his faithful sidekick, Bill, inside the new FM control room. They are seated at opposite ends of the brand new control board. Jimmy is the first to speak.
I have this pistol. One bullet in chamber. Spin cylinder. Cock the gun. Haul the gun to your head and pull the trigger. I go first. Good luck. Now you go. Here's the pistol.
What do you say we make it 2 out of 3?
Meanwhile, back upstairs in his office, Harvey Jacobs calls the Federal Communications Commission to ask approval to begin broadcasting. There is no answer. Harvey, as usual, stands for no nonsense and goes straight to the top of things. He calls the FCC commissioner at home. As we look in on HCJ, he is dialing the commissioner.
May I talk to your father, please?